Muhammad, Disc 5.
At about the same time, Muhammad's new father-in-law, Abu Bara, chief of the Bedouin tribe of Amir, asked for help against warring factions in his own tribe. 40 Muslims were dispatched, and nearly all of them were massacred just outside Amir's territory by members of the tribe of Sulaym. When one of the Muslim survivors came across two Amiris lying peacefully asleep under a tree, he killed them, assuming that their tribe had been responsible for the killing and taking revenge in the traditional fashion. When he returned to Medina, Muhammad told him that he had done wrong. But the tradition of retaliation was so deeply ingrained in Arabia that it was nearly impossible to eradicate. Muhammad insisted on paying the usual compensation to Abu Bara. His willingness to do so, in spite of the fact that the crime had technically been committed by tribesmen of Sulaym, made some of the Bedouin more kindly disposed towards the Muslim community. Some of the Sulaymites had been so impressed by the courage of their Muslim victims that they entered Islam themselves. Muhammad's position in Medina remained precarious, and he could not afford to drop his guard. When he called upon the Jewish tribe of Nadir to collect the blood money for Amir, he narrowly escaped an assassination attempt. Some members of Nadir had planned to drop a boulder on the Prophet from a nearby rooftop. Ibn Ubay had promised to support them, and they probably assumed that Muhammad had been so discredited by Uhud that the Medinese would rally behind them. So they were astonished to receive a grim message from their former ally, the tribe of Aus. They had broken their treaty with the Prophet and could no longer remain in the city. Like Kainuka before them, the Nadiris withdrew to their fortress and waited for their allies to relieve them. But again, no help was forthcoming. Even the powerful Jewish tribe of Quraiza, which was also hostile to Muhammad, told them that they were on their own. After 2 weeks, Nadir knew that they could no longer sustain the siege, and when Muhammad gave the order to cut down their palm trees, an unmistakable sign of war in Arabia, they surrendered, begging only that their lives be spared. Muhammad agreed, on condition that they left the oasis immediately, taking with them only those goods that they could carry on their camels. So Nadir packed up their possessions, even taking down the lintels of their doors rather than leave them to Muhammad, and left Medina in a proud procession as though they were going in triumph. The women dressed in all their jewels and finery, beating tambourines and singing to the accompaniment of pipes and drums. Weaving their way through the orchards and hamlets of the oasis, they finally took the road to Syria, though some stayed in the nearby Jewish settlement of Khaybar, where they helped Abu Sufyan build his confederacy against the Muslims by drumming up support among the northern tribes. In the space of 2 short years, Muhammad had expelled 2 powerful tribes from Medina, and the Muslims now managed the market vacated by Kainuka. As we have seen, this was not Muhammad's intention. He had wanted to cut the cycle of violence and dispossession, not continue it. Muhammad had shown that he was still a man to be reckoned with, but he must also have reflected on the moral and political sterility of this type of success, because Nadir remained just as much of a threat in nearby Khaybar. It was nearly time to make good on Abu Sufyan's parting shot after Uhud, next year at Badr. But Muhammad was playing a very dangerous game. He had to make a show of strength, but his troops were so dispirited that he could not risk another pitched battle. Nevertheless, during the week of Badr's annual Sukk, he rode there with 1,500 men. Fortunately for the Prophet, Abu Sufyan did not appear. He hadn't expected the Muslims to keep the appointment, and had set out with his army as a mere show, planning to turn back as soon as he heard that Muhammad had failed to leave Medina. It was a year of severe drought, and there wasn't a blade of grass to feed the camels during the journey. So, with only a few days' supplies packed, Abu Sufyan had to lead his men home. He was bitterly reproached by the Meccans, because the Bedouin were full of admiration for the Muslims' courage. In Medina, Muhammad's position was still weak. But in the peninsula as a whole, the tide was beginning to turn in his favour. Whenever he heard that a Bedouin tribe had joined the Meccan Confederacy, he would lead a Ghazu to capture its flocks and herds, even if it meant a trek of 500 miles to the Syrian border. In June 626, he learned that some clans of the Bedouin tribe of Ghatafan were planning a raid against Medina. So he set out to repel the expedition. When the Muslims came face to face with the enemy at Dat al-Rika, he once again avoided a direct confrontation. But for 3 days the Muslims remained face to face with the enemy. Both Tabari and Ibn Ishaq make it clear that the Muslim troops were terrified. But so, it seems, were the Ghatafan. In this atmosphere of terror, the Prophet received a revelation that instituted the prayer of fear, an abridged form of the usual prostrations adapted for a military emergency. Instead of making themselves vulnerable to the enemy by praying en masse at the appointed times, Muslims should pray in relays with their arms at the ready. In the end, the battle simply fizzled out before it began. Ghatafan withdrew, and Muhammad could return to Medina, having achieved a symbolic victory. The prayer of fear showed how beleaguered and defensive the new religion had become. It was in this context that we must see the Quran's apparent retreat from gender equality. In January 626, his new wife Zainab had died, just 8 months after their wedding. Not long afterwards, he approached Hind bint Abi Umayyah, the widow of his cousin Abu Salama, who had died after Uhud, leaving her with 4 children. Hind, or Salama, as she was usually known, was 29 years old. Beautiful, sophisticated, and extremely intelligent, she would provide the Prophet with the kind of companionship he had enjoyed with Khadija. She was also the sister of a leading member of Makhzum, one of the most powerful Meccan clans. At first, she was reluctant to marry Muhammad. She had loved her husband very much, she explained. She was no longer young, had a jealous disposition, and was not sure that she could adapt to life in the harem. Muhammad smiled. He had a smile of great sweetness, which almost everybody found disarming, and assured her that in his late 50s he was even older than she, and that God would cure her jealousy. She was right to be wary, because life in the mosque was not easy. The apartments of Muhammad's wives were so tiny that it was almost impossible to stand upright inside them. Muhammad did not have a house of his own. He passed the night with each of his wives in turn, and her hut became his official residence for the day. There was practically no privacy, as Muhammad was constantly surrounded by crowds of people. He had frequent visits from his daughters and grandchildren. He was devoted to Hassan and Hussein, the sons of Ali and Fatima, and was especially fond of his little granddaughter Umama, whom he would carry into the mosque on his shoulders. He was constantly closeted with his closest companions. Abu Bakr, Zayd, Ali, Uthman, and, increasingly, Omar. As he became more widely respected in Arabia, he also received delegations from the Bedouin tribes, who crowded into the courtyard with their camels. When he left the mosque after prayers, hordes of petitioners herded around their prophet, pulling at his garments and yelling their questions and demands into his face. they would follow him into his wife's hut, thronging around the table so tightly that it was sometimes impossible to pick up a morsel of food. This was stressful for Muhammad, who was shy, fastidious, and sensitive to unpleasant bodily odours and bad breath. He was also getting older. He still had only a few grey hairs, and walked so energetically that his feet scarcely seemed to touch the ground. But he was nearly 60, a not inconsiderable age in Arabia. He had been injured at Uhud, and the constant pressure was beginning to tell on him at a time when the whole of Medina was waiting in terror for the inevitable return of the Meccan army, and the Ummah was more divided than ever before. This internal dissension became apparent as soon as Salama took up residence in the mosque. Aisha fiercely resented the arrival of this distinguished superior woman, and a rift developed in the harem that reflected tensions within the Ummah itself. Salama represented the more aristocratic emigrants, while Aisha and Hafsa, the daughters of Abu Bakr and Umar, came from the more plebeian party in power. Each of Muhammad's wives sided with one of these two rival factions. Salama often relied upon the support of a third group, the Ahl al-Bayt, the people of the household, who were members of Muhammad's immediate family. At the time of her marriage to Muhammad, these divisions were only in their infancy. But it would soon become clear that the Ummah was not a monolithic group, and that the people who entered Islam had done so with very different expectations. Salama quickly became the spokesperson for the women of Medina. Muhammad's living arrangements, which had physically positioned his wives at the epicentre of the community, had given Muslim women a new vision of their role. Aisha and Hafsa were still young girls and were sometimes flighty and selfish, but Salama was a very different proposition. Shortly after her marriage, a deputation of women asked her why they were mentioned so rarely in the Quran. Salama brought their question to the Prophet, who, as usual, took time to reflect upon it seriously. A few days later, while she was combing her hair in her apartment, she heard Muhammad reciting a revolutionary new surah in the mosque. Men and women who have surrendered, believing men and believing women, obedient men and obedient women, truthful men and truthful women, enduring men and enduring women, men and women who give in charity, men who fast and women who fast, men and women who guard their private parts, men and women who remember God oft, for them God has prepared forgiveness and a mighty wage. In other words, there was to be complete sexual equality in Islam. Both men and women had the same duties and responsibilities. When the women heard these verses, they were determined to make this vision a concrete reality in their daily lives. God seemed to be on their side. Shortly afterwards, a whole surah was dedicated to women. Women were no longer to be bequeathed to male heirs as though they were camels or date palms. They could themselves inherit and compete with men for a share in an estate. No orphan girl should be married to her guardian against her will as though she were simply a piece of movable property. As had been customary during the pre-Islamic period, women retained the power to initiate divorce proceedings, though the husband could refuse to comply. In Arabia, the groom traditionally presented a dowry to his bride, but in practice this gift had belonged to her family. Now the dowry was to be given directly to the woman as her inalienable property, and in the event of divorce, a man could not reclaim it, so her security was assured. Quranic legislation insisted that the individual was free and sovereign, and that also applied to women. In 7th century Arabia, this was a shocking innovation, and the men of the Ummah were furious. God was taking away their privileges. They were ready to fight for him to the death, but now he was demanding sacrifice in their personal lives. The Medinese were particularly incensed. Were they expected to divide their farms to give women a share? How, they asked, can one give the right of inheritance to women and children who do not work and do not earn their living? Are they now going to inherit, just like men who have worked to earn that money? And was the prophet seriously telling them that even an ugly girl could inherit a fortune? Yes, absolutely, replied Muhammad. Some tried to find a loophole in the legislation, but the women complained to Muhammad, and the Quran supported them. Another demand. Since raiding was so crucial to the economy, why could they not bear arms too? Once again, Salama brought their question to the Prophet. This went right to the heart of the Ghazu economy. A woman who was taken prisoner during a raid was valuable booty. She could be sold, married, used for labour, or forced into prostitution. If women were allowed to fight, instead of waiting passively to be taken prisoner, there would be a huge reduction of raiding income. The controversy split the community, and Muhammad was besieged by angry men who felt that Allah was emasculating them. Omar especially could not understand the Prophet's ridiculous leniency towards women. But Muhammad stood firm and insisted that God had made his will clear. But the women had chosen the wrong movement to make their move. There was no way that the men would accept this at a time when the Ummah faced extinction. The laws of inheritance and divorce remained in place, but Muhammad found that his enemies in Medina were making political capital out of this radical legislation, and that he was opposed at this crucial juncture by some of his closest companions. Matters came to a head over the question of wife beating. The Quran forbade Muslims to inflict violence upon one another, and the women began to complain to the Prophet when their husbands hit them, demanding that they be punished as the Quran prescribed. Some even started to refuse sex to their abusive husbands. Muhammad was revolted by the very idea of violence towards women. The Prophet never raised his hand against one of his wives, or against a slave, nor against any person at all, the historian Ibn Sa'd recalled. He was always against the beating of women. But he was ahead of his time. Men like Omar, Ibn Ubay, and even the gentle Abu Bakr beat their wives without giving the matter a second thought. Knowing that Abu Sufyan was mustering a massive army against Medina, Muhammad had to give way in order to retain the loyalty of his men. Very well, he told his indignant companions, beat them. But only the worst of you will have recourse to such methods. A revelation seemed to give husbands permission to beat their wives, but Muhammad did not like it. I cannot bear seeing a quick-tempered man beat his wife in a fit of anger, he said. Yet again, the conflict with Mecca had compromised his vision and forced him to adopt a course of action that, in more normal circumstances, he would have preferred to avoid. The Quranic legislation about women is intertwined with verses about the war, which inevitably affected everything that happened in Medina at this time. Muhammad knew that he had no hope of surviving a Meccan onslaught with disaffected troops. In March 627, a massive army of 10,000 men, the Quraysh and their confederates, were on the march toward Medina. Muhammad could only raise a paltry 3,000 warriors from Medina and his Bedouin allies. This time there was no stupid bravado. The Muslims barricaded themselves into the city in the centre of the oasis. Surrounded on three sides by cliffs and plains of volcanic rock, Medina was not difficult to defend. It was most vulnerable from the north. But Muhammad adopted a stratagem suggested to him by Salman al-Fassi, a Persian convert. The Quraysh were in no hurry, making their way grandly and confidently in easy stages, so the Muslims had plenty of time from the outlying fields, so that this time the Meccans would find no fodder. And then the entire community set to work digging a huge trench around the northern part of the oasis. This was nothing short of astonishing, even shocking, to Arab sensibilities. No self-respecting Jahili warrior would dream of putting a barrier between himself and the enemy. He would consider it degrading to shovel earth like a slave. But Muhammad worked alongside his companions, laughing, joking, and singing with his men. Morale was high. When the Quraysh arrived with their army, they stared blankly at the trench. The earth from the ditch had been used to build a high escarpment, which effectively shielded the Medinese in their camp and gave them a superior vantage point from which to hurl missiles. The Quraysh were bewildered. They had never seen anything so unsporting in their lives. Their cavalry, which was their pride and joy, was useless. From time to time, one of their horsemen would try to lead a dashing charge towards the enemy lines, only to screech absurdly to a halt when he arrived at the dugout. The siege lasted only a month, but it seemed endless. Feeding and supplying the allies of Medina, as well as their own people, put a great strain on the city's resources. Ibn Ubay and his party accused Muhammad of bringing ruin upon them, and the Jewish tribe of Quraiza openly supported the Quraysh. The Jews of Khaybar had contributed a large squadron to the Meccan army, which included many of the exiled tribe of Nadir. Before the arrival of the Meccan army, Huyai ibn Aktab, chief of Nadir, had tried to persuade Quraiza either to attack the Muslims from the rear or to smuggle 2,000 Nadiris into the oasis to slaughter the women and children in the fortresses. Initially, Quraiza were hesitant, but when they saw the vast Meccan army filling the plain in front of the city as far as the eye could see, their chief agreed to help the Confederacy and provide the Quraysh with weapons and supplies. When Muhammad heard of this treachery, he was visibly distressed. He sent Sa'd ibn Mu'ad, who had been Quraiza's chief Arab ally before the Hijra, to negotiate, but to no avail. At one point, the Quraiza actually started to attack the fortresses on the southeast of the settlement, but the effort petered out. For about 3 weeks, it was quite unclear which way they would go. Throughout the Battle of the Trench, as the siege became known, the Muslims were terrified. Faced with the prospect of extermination, some came close to despair. "Your eyes swerved and your hearts reached your throats," the Quran recalled, "while you thought strange thoughts about God." Here it was that the believers were tried and shaken most mightily. Those inside the city trembled. On the other side of the ditch, the Quraysh were becoming exhausted. They had inadequate provisions, and their inexperience in military affairs meant that they were easily demoralized by a sudden reversal. Their resolve finally snapped when a violent rainstorm devastated their camp. Abu Sufyan recognized defeat. Horses and camels were dying, the Quraysh had failed to deliver, and his troops had no tents, fires, or cooking pots. "Be off," he announced to his men, "for I am going." When the Muslims peered over the escarpment the next morning, the plain was completely deserted. But what was Muhammad to do about Quraiza? The departure of the Quraysh had not weakened the bitter opposition to his leadership within Medina. His opponents were convinced that the Meccans would return in the not-too-distant future and wreak terrible vengeance for their humiliation. So they intensified their campaign against him. The settlement was on the brink of civil war, and in this explosive climate, the Quraysh could not remain unpunished. The day after the departure of the Meccan army, Muhammad's troops surrounded the fortress of Qurayza, who asked that they be permitted to leave on the same terms as Qaynuqa and Nadir. But this time, Muhammad refused. Nadir had proved to be just as dangerous to the Ummah in exile. The elders of Qurayza agreed to accept the arbitration of their former ally, Sa'd ibn Mu'ad, who had been severely wounded during the siege, and was carried to the Qurayza village on a litter. Even though some of the other tribes asked him to be merciful, Sa'd believed that the Qurayza were an unacceptable security risk and made the conventional judgment. All 700 men of the tribe should be executed, their wives and children sold into slavery, and their property divided among the Muslims. When he heard the verdict, Muhammad is reported to have cried, "You have judged according to the ruling of Allah, above the seven skies." The next day, the sentence was carried out. Revolting as it seems to us today, almost everybody in Arabia would have expected Sa'd's judgment. According to the texts, not even the Qurayza were surprised by the decision. The execution sent a grim message to the Jews of Khaybar, and the Bedouin would have noted that Muhammad did not shrink from retaliation. He had staged a defiant show of strength, which, it was hoped, would bring the conflict to an end. Change was coming to this desperate, primitive society, but for the time being, violence and killing on this scale were the norm. Nevertheless, the incident marks the nadir of Muhammad's career. It is, however, important to note that the Qurayza were not killed on religious or racial grounds. None of the other Jewish tribes in the oasis either objected or attempted to intervene, clearly regarding it as a purely political and tribal matter. A significant number of the Arab tribe of Kilab, the clients of Qurayza, were also executed alongside the Jews. Muhammad had no ideological quarrel with the Jewish people. He once said, "He who wrongs or destroys a Jew or a Christian will have me to answer to on the day of judgment." The men of Qurayza were executed for treason. The 17 other Jewish tribes of Medina remained in the oasis, living on friendly terms with the Muslims for many years, and the Quran continued to insist that Muslims remember their spiritual kinship with the people of the followers of earlier revelation otherwise than in a most kindly manner, unless it be such of them as are bent upon evil-doing, and say, "We believe in that which has been bestowed from on high upon us, as well as that which has been bestowed upon you. For our God and your God is one and the same, and it is unto him that we all surrender ourselves." Later in the Islamic empires, Jews would enjoy full religious liberty, and anti-Semitism would not become a Muslim vice until the Arab-Israeli conflict became acute in the mid-20th century. The tragedy of Qurayza may have seemed expedient to the Arabs of Muhammad's time, but it is not acceptable to us today. Nor was it what Muhammad had set out to do. His original aim had been to end the violence of Jahiliyyah, but he was now behaving like an ordinary Arab chieftain. He had felt impelled to go to war in order to achieve a final peace. But the fighting had unleashed a grim and vicious cycle of strike and counter-strike, atrocity and retaliation, which violated essential principles of Islam. As he rode away from the village of Qurayza, towards a city that was still seething with resentment, Muhammad must have realized that he would have to find another way to end the conflict. Somehow, he had to abandon this Jahili behaviour once and for all and find an entirely different solution. Chapter 5. Salam. Muhammad's victory over the Quraysh greatly enhanced his prestige in the peninsula. During the next few months, he capitalized on this, dispatching raiding parties against tribes who belonged to the Meccan Confederacy, hoping to tighten the economic blockade that was damaging Quraysh trade and attract some of the Syrian caravans to Medina. His continuing success made many of the Arabs question the validity of their traditional faith. They were pragmatic people, less interested in abstract speculation than in the effectiveness of a religious system. When the Meccan army had left Medina after the siege, the commander, Khalid ibn al-Walid, had cried, "Every man of sense now knows that Muhammad has not lied." Even the most committed adherents of the old faith were beginning to agree. During a raid against one of the Meccan caravans, Muhammad's former son-in-law, Abu al-As, who had been ready to give up his family rather than accept Islam, was taken prisoner. Muhammad ordered that he be released and his merchandise returned to him, and this second act of generosity so impressed Abu al-As that after he had taken the goods back to Mecca, he made the hijrah, converted to Islam, and was reunited with Zainab and their little daughter. In Arabia as a whole, the tide had turned in Muhammad's favour. But within Medina, the opposite was true. There the conflict had become more venomous than ever. Every day Ibn Ubay insinuated that had he retained the leadership, Yathrib could have been pacified without incurring the lethal enmity of the most powerful city in Arabia. Muhammad's enemies rarely attacked him openly, but conducted a somewhat underhanded smear campaign. His controversial attempt to improve the status of women was a godsend to them, and they began to circulate malicious and salacious rumours about his wives. Some made it known that they had their eye on some of the more attractive members of his harem and intended to marry them after his death, a suggestion that carried more than a hint of assassination. It was whispered that Muhammad was now too old to satisfy his wives, or that he had a testicular hernia. There was a good deal of spiteful gossip about Aisha and a young man called Safwan ibn al-Mu'attal. When people crowded into his family quarters to put their questions and complaints to Muhammad, some of the men had actually insulted his wives before his very eyes. The situation was getting out of hand. At night, when it was cooler, Medina came to life, and people liked to walk about and socialize outside, enjoying the fresher air. But since the siege, women had been attacked on the streets. When the Prophet's wives went out together, the hypocrites had started to follow them, yelling obscene suggestions and making lewd gestures. When challenged, they protested that in the darkness they had mistaken the women for slave girls, who were considered fair game for this type of harassment.
He was emotionally and physically drained by the strain of the last few years. He had always been emotionally dependent upon his women, and this made him vulnerable.
When he decided to take another wife, tongues started to wag again. Zainab bint Jash had always been close to Muhammad. She was his cousin, but she was also the wife of Zayd, his adopted son. Muhammad had arranged the match himself shortly after the hijrah, even though Zainab had been far from enthusiastic. Zayd was not physically prepossessing, and she may even then have been interested in Muhammad himself. Zainab was now in her late 30s, but despite the harsh climate and conditions of Arabia, she was still extremely beautiful. A pious woman, she was a skilled leather worker and gave all the proceeds of her craft to the poor. Muhammad seems to have seen her with new eyes and to have fallen in love quite suddenly when he had called at her house one afternoon to speak to Zayd, who happened to be out. Not expecting any visitors, Zainab had come to the door in dishabille, more revealingly dressed than usual, and Muhammad had averted his eyes hastily, muttering, "Praise be to Allah who changes men's hearts."
Shortly afterwards, Zainab and Zaid were divorced. Their marriage had never been happy, and Zaid was glad to release her. This story has shocked some of Muhammad's Western critics, who are used to more ascetic Christian heroes. But the Muslim sources seem to find nothing untoward in this demonstration of their prophet's virility. Nor are they disturbed that Muhammad had more than four wives. Why shouldn't God give his prophet a few privileges? What scandalized his opponents in Medina was the fact that Zainab had been married to Zaid. Arabs regarded adoption as conferring an almost biological relationship, and there was much scandalized talk about incest. Muhammad was reassured on this point by a revelation that assured him that Allah himself desired the match and that it was not sinful to marry the spouse of an adopted child. Aisha, who was always prone to jealousy, happened to be with Muhammad when he received this divine message. "How very convenient," she remarked tartly. "Truly thy Lord makes haste to do thy bidding." As usual, tensions in the harem reflected divisions in the community as a whole. Muhammad's marriage to one of his own cousins would further the political ends of the Prophet's family, advancing the cause of the people of the household. Because of the scandal, Muhammad insisted that the entire community attend the wedding celebrations. The courtyard was crowded with guests, many of them hostile to the Prophet, and the atmosphere would not have been pleasant. Eventually, the party began to break up, but a small group remained behind in Zainab's new apartment, apparently blissfully unaware that it was time for the bride and groom to be alone. Muhammad left the room and sat with his other wives, hoping that these tactless guests would take the hint. "How do you like your new companion?" Aisha inquired acidly when he dropped in on her. He eventually returned to Zainab's hut, where the revelers were finally being ushered out by his friend Anas ibn Malik. As he entered the room, Muhammad somewhat impatiently drew a curtain, or hijab, between himself and Anas, uttering the words of a new revelation.
"O you who have attained to faith,
do not enter the Prophet's dwellings unless you are given leave, and when invited to a meal, do not come so early as to wait for it to be readied. But whenever you are invited, enter at the proper time. And when you have partaken of the meal, disperse without lingering for the sake of mere talk. That, behold, might give offence to the Prophet, and yet he might feel shy of asking you to leave. But God is not shy of teaching you what is right. And as for the Prophet's wives, whenever you ask them for anything that you need, ask them from behind a screen. This will but deepen the purity of your hearts and theirs." The revelation went on to ordain that Muhammad's wives should not remarry after his death, and ordered them to wear their jilbab, a word that could refer to various garments, in a distinctive way so that they could be recognized in the street and avoid harassment. The hijab verses have become extremely controversial. They would eventually, about three generations after the Prophet's death, be used to justify the veiling of all women and their seclusion in a separate part of the house. But they must be seen in context. They occur in Surah 33, which also deals with the siege, and must be considered against this frightening backdrop. These directives did not apply to all Muslim women, but only to Muhammad's wives. They were prompted by the thinly disguised threats of Muhammad's enemies and the aggressive encroachment upon his personal space and the abuse to which his wives were subjected almost daily. The poisonous atmosphere of Medina after the siege had compelled Muhammad to change his personal arrangements. Henceforth, there would be no open house. Instead of crowding freely into his wives' apartments, Muslims must approach them from behind a protective screen. The word hijab comes from the root hijb, to hide. The curtain established a threshold,
It shielded a forbidden or sacred object, like the damask cloth that covered the Kaaba. In times of vulnerability, women's bodies often symbolize the endangered community. And in our own day, the hijab has acquired new importance in seeming to protect the Ummah from the threat of the West. Muhammad had not wanted to separate his private life from his public duties. He continued to take his wives on military expeditions, though they would now remain in their tent. But the other women of the Ummah continued to move around the oasis freely. The hijab was not devised to divide the sexes. In fact, when the revelation had come down, the curtain had been drawn between two men, the Prophet and Anas, to separate the married couple from the hostile community. The introduction of the hijab was a victory for Umar, who had been urging the Prophet to segregate his wives for some time, a somewhat superficial solution to a complex problem. Muhammad had wanted to change people's attitudes, and the imposition of this external barrier was a compromise because it did not require Muslims to exercise an internal control over their actions. But he gave in to Umar because of the crisis that was tearing Medina apart. But the situation did not improve. A few weeks after the introduction of the hijab, Muhammad's enemies orchestrated a vicious attack on Aisha, which devastated the Prophet and almost succeeded in dividing the community. Aisha was an easy target. Everybody knew that she was Muhammad's favourite. She was beautiful, spirited, proud of her prominent position, jealous, outspoken, not without egotism, and had doubtless made many enemies. On this occasion, Muhammad had chosen Aisha to accompany him on an expedition against an ally of the Quraysh, who had somewhat menacingly encamped a little closer to Medina than usual. According to Muhammad's spies, the Quraysh had persuaded them to attack the oasis. It was a successful raid. The Muslims intercepted them at the well of Muraisi on the Red Sea coast and managed to carry off 200 camels, 500 sheep and 200 of their women. Juwairia bint al-Harith, daughter of the chief, was among the captives. Aisha's heart sank as soon as she set eyes on her because Juwairia was so pretty. And sure enough, during the negotiations that followed the raid, Muhammad proposed marriage to seal the alliance with her father. The Muslims camped at Muraisi for 3 days, but despite the positive outcome of the Ghazu, the simmering tension between the emigrants and the helpers escalated into a serious incident. While the Muslims were watering their camels at a well, local people from two different tribes, one confederated to the Quraysh, the other to the Khazraj, started to quarrel about a fairly trivial matter. Before long, there was a full-scale brawl, and the combatants called upon the Muslim bystanders for help. The emigrants rushed to the aid of the tribesmen who were allied to the Quraysh, while the helpers from Khazraj rallied around their opponents. In a matter of moments, in direct violation of the Quran, Muslim was fighting Muslim. When they heard the news, Umar and some of Muhammad's other companions rushed in to stop this unseemly fighting. But Ibn Ubay was enraged. How dared Umar prevent the Khazraj from helping their own allies? "They seek to take precedence over us," he cried. "By Allah, when we return to Medina, the higher and mightier of us will drive out the lower and the weaker." A bystander ran immediately to report this to Muhammad, who paled when he heard this latest threat. Umar wanted to have Ibn Ubay executed immediately, but Muhammad restrained him. Did he want it said that the Prophet killed his own companions? But he gave the Muslims orders to decamp immediately and begin the trek home, even though this meant travelling through the worst heat of the day, something he had never done before. Aisha slipped away to relieve herself, and when she returned, found that she had mislaid her necklace. It had been a wedding gift from her mother,
and she could not bear to lose it, so she went back to search for it. While she was gone, the men lifted her litter, duly shrouded with the hijab, onto her camel, assuming that she was safely inside, and the party moved off without her. Aisha was not too distressed when she discovered the deserted campsite, because she knew that it was only a matter of time before somebody missed her. She sat down to wait, and, sure enough, her old friend Safwan ibn al-Muattal, who had fallen behind the others, turned up and put her on the back of his own camel. When Aisha rejoined the expedition with Safwan, the old rumour about their illicit relationship started up again, and Muhammad's enemies gleefully imagined the worst. It was not surprising that Aisha had fallen for Safwan, Ibn Ubay remarked loudly, because he was so much younger and more attractive than her husband. The scandal rocked Medina, and the story seemed so plausible that some of the emigrants began to believe it, and even Abu Bakr, Aisha's father, began to suspect that it might be true. More seriously, Muhammad himself began to doubt Aisha's innocence, a telling sign of his waning confidence during this difficult period. For a few days, he seemed confused and uncertain. His need for Aisha was so great that, faced with the possibility of losing her, he seemed confused and hesitant. He no longer received any messages from God. It was the first time since the very beginning of his prophetic career that the divine voice had fallen silent. Ibn Ubay continued to exploit the situation, and old tribal hatreds flared as the Khazraj, Ibn Ubay's tribe, threatened to fight the Aus, who argued that the people who were stirring the scandal should be immediately executed. The situation was so grave that Muhammad was forced to summon all the chiefs of Medina to a meeting and ask for their support, should he find it necessary to take action against Ibn Ubay, who was threatening his family. Finally, Muhammad went to confront to Aisha, who had taken refuge in her parents' home. She had wept for 2 days, but her tears dried like magic as soon as her husband entered the house, and she faced him calmly. Muhammad urged her to confess her sin honestly. If she repented, God would forgive her. But with great dignity, the 14-year-old girl stood her ground and gazed steadfastly at her husband as she made her reply. There seemed little point in her saying anything at all, she said. She could not admit to something she had not done, and if she protested her innocence, nobody, not even her own parents, would believe her. She could only repeat the words of the prophet Jacob in the Quran, "Patience in adversity is most goodly in the sight of God, and it is to God alone that I pray to give me strength to bear the misfortune which you have described to me." She then turned silently and lay down on her bed. Aisha through and through, and she must have convinced him, because as soon as she had finished speaking, he fell into the deep trance that was so often a prelude to revelation. He swooned, and Abu Bakr put a leather cushion under his head while he and his wife waited, terrified, for God's judgment. "Good news, Aisha!" Muhammad cried at last. God had confirmed her innocence. Overcome with relief, her parents urged her to get up and come to her husband, but Aisha remained implacable. "I shall neither come to him nor thank him," she replied, "nor will I thank the both of you, who listened to the slander and did not deny it. I shall rise and give thanks to Allah alone." Duly chastened, Muhammad humbly accepted the rebuke and went to recite the new revelation to the crowd that had gathered outside. A personal and political tragedy had been averted, but doubts remained. The distressing incident had shown how vulnerable Muhammad was. Was he, as Ibn Ubay had so cruelly suggested, a spent fire? But in March 628,
the month of the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca, Muhammad made a startling announcement that proved to be an extraordinary demonstration of his prophetic genius. It seems that he had no clearly defined plan at the outset, but only a dimly perceived insight. He told the Muslims that he had had a strange, numinous dream. He had seen himself standing in the Haram of Mecca with the shaven head of the pilgrim, wearing the traditional Hajji costume and holding the key to the Kaaba, filled with a serene assurance of victory. The next morning, he announced that he intended to make the Hajj pilgrimage and invited his companions to accompany him. It is easy to imagine the fear, wonder, and uncertain joy that filled the Muslims when they heard this startling invitation. Muhammad made it clear that this would not be a military expedition. Pilgrims were forbidden to carry weapons during the Hajj, and he had no intention of violating the Meccan sanctuary, where all fighting was forbidden. Umar objected. The Muslims would go like lambs to the slaughter. It was essential that they were able to defend themselves. But Muhammad was adamant. "I will not carry arms," he said firmly. "I am setting out with no other end than to make the pilgrimage." The pilgrims would wear no armour, but simply the traditional white robes of the Hajji. At the beginning of the journey, they could carry a small hunting knife to kill game, but they would have to lay these aside once they had made their formal consecration. They would have to march unarmed into enemy territory. None of the Bedouin who had joined Muhammad's confederacy was prepared to take the risk, but about 1,000 emigrants and helpers volunteered. Even Ibn Ubay and some of the hypocrites decided to go. Two women helpers who had been present at the Pledge of Aqaba were allowed to join the party, and Salama accompanied Muhammad. The Muslims set off with the camels that they would sacrifice at the climax of the Hajj. At the first stop, Muhammad consecrated one of these camels in the traditional way, making special marks on it, hanging the ritual garments round its neck and turning it in the direction of Mecca. He then uttered the pilgrim cry, "Here I am, O God, at your service." The news of this audacious expedition spread quickly from one tribe to another, and the Bedouin followed their progress intently as the pilgrims made the long journey south. Muhammad knew that he was placing the Quraysh in an extremely difficult position. Every Arab had the right to make the Hajj, and if the Quraysh, the guardians of the Haram, forbade 1,000 pilgrims who were punctiliously observing the rites to enter the sanctuary, they would be guilty of a gross dereliction of duty. But it would also be intolerably humiliating for the Quraysh if Muhammad did enter the city, and it soon became clear that the Quraishian leadership was determined to stop Muhammad at any price. In an emergency meeting of the assembly, Khalid ibn al-Walid was dispatched with 200 cavalry to attack the defenceless pilgrims. When he heard this grave news, Muhammad was filled with anguish for his tribe. The Quraysh were so blinded by the sterile hatred of warfare that they were prepared to violate the sacred principles on which their entire way of life depended. What was the point of such intransigence? "Alas, Quraysh," he cried, "war has devoured them. What harm would they have suffered if they had left me and the rest of the Arabs to go our own ways?" The expedition was going to be quite different from what he had imagined. Because of his dream, Muhammad had probably expected to be admitted to Mecca and have the opportunity to explain the principles of Islam to the Quraysh in the peaceful conditions imposed by the Hajj. But he could not turn back now. "By Allah," he resolved, "I will not cease to strive for the mission with which God has entrusted me, until he makes it victorious or I perish. His first task was to get the pilgrims safely into the sanctuary. The Muslims found a guide from the friendly Bedouin tribe of Aslam, who led the party by a circuitous, rugged path into the area where all violence was forbidden.
As soon as he entered the sacred zone,
Muhammad reminded the pilgrims that they were engaged in a strictly religious activity. They must not allow themselves to be carried away by the excitement of homecoming. There must be no facile triumph, and they must put their sins behind them. Now they should make their way to the nearby well of Hudaybiyah, getting their camels to kick up the sand so that Khalid and his men would know exactly where they were. When they reached Hudaybiyah, Muhammad's camel, Qaswa, fell to her knees and refused to budge. The pilgrims yelled at her, trying to make her get up, but Muhammad reminded them of the elephant who had knelt before the Kaaba during the Abyssinian invasion all those years ago, a divine sign that had persuaded the enemy army to turn back without a fight. Something similar was happening today. The one who restrained the elephant from entering Mecca is keeping Qaswa back, he explained. And yet again, he reminded the pilgrims that they were coming in a spirit of reconciliation. Whatever condition the Quraysh make in which they ask me to show kindness to kindred, I shall agree to. Muhammad had never planned to overthrow the Quraysh, but had simply wanted to reform the social system which, he was convinced, would bring the city to ruin. The Quraysh thought that their pilgrimage amounted to a declaration of war, but, like Qaswa, Muhammad was determined to prostrate himself humbly before the holiness of Mecca. The war had achieved nothing of lasting value, and both sides had committed atrocities. This was to be a peaceful offensive, not an invasion. But very few of the Muslims took Muhammad seriously. Keyed up by the excitement and drama of the occasion, they were expecting something spectacular. Perhaps there would be a miracle. Maybe they would enter Mecca in triumph and drive the Quraysh from the city. Instead, Muhammad calmly ordered them to water their camels and sit down beside them. What followed was what used to be called a sit-in. Waiting obediently for permission to enter the city, refraining from violence, Muhammad was demonstrating that he was more in line with Arab tradition than the Quraysh, who had been prepared to kill him while he was making his way unarmed toward the sacred ground. And indeed, the Bedouin got the message. A chief of Quzaa, who was visiting Mecca, rode out to Hudaybiyah to see what was going on. He was horrified to hear that the pilgrims had been denied access to the holy places and went back to the city to protest angrily to the Quraysh. Mecca had always been an inclusive city. It had welcomed all Arabs to the Haram, and this pluralism had been the source of its commercial success. What did they think they were doing? They had no right to bar a man who had clearly come in peace, he complained. But the Quraysh elders laughed in his face. They were prepared to stand between Muhammad and the Kaaba and fight him until their last man had been killed. He may not have come wanting war, they cried, but by Allah he shall never come in against our will, nor shall the Arabs ever say that we have allowed it. At this point, the Meccan resistance to Muhammad was led by Suhail, the pious pagan whom Muhammad had hoped to attract to Islam, and the sons of some of Islam's earliest opponents. Ikrimah, who, like his father Abu Jahil, was implacably opposed to any compromise, and Safwan ibn Umayyah, whose father had died at Badr. Abu Sufyan seems to have played no part in the events of Hudaybiyah. A man of outstanding intelligence, he probably realized that Muhammad had wrong-footed the Quraysh and that it was no longer possible to deal with him with the conventional defiance of Jahiliyyah. The Meccans had tried to kill the pilgrims, but Muhammad had eluded them. Their next ploy was to try to cause dissension among the Muslims by inviting Ibn Ubay to perform the rites at the Kaaba. But to everybody's surprise, Ibn Ubay replied that he could not possibly perform the circumambulations before the Prophet. He would clash with Muhammad again in the future, but at Hudaybiyah, Ibn Ubay was a loyal Muslim. Safwan and Suhail persuaded Ikrimah to agree to negotiation and sent one of their Bedouin allies, Hulayz, chief of Al-Hari, an extremely devout man, as their representative. When Muhammad saw him coming, he sent the sacrificial camels out to greet him. And when Hulayz saw them trotting towards him, beautifully decked out in their garlands, he was so impressed that he did not even bother to interrogate Muhammad, but returned immediately to the city. These were bona fide pilgrims, he reported, who must be admitted at once to the Haram. Safwan was furious. How dared Hulayz, an ignorant Bedouin, give them orders? This was a grave mistake. Hulayz rose and replied with great dignity, "You men of Quraysh, it was not for this that we made an alliance with you. Is a man who comes to do honour to the house of Allah to be excluded from it? By him who holds my life in his hand, either you let Muhammad do what he has come to do, or I shall take away my troops to the last man." Safwan hastily apologised and asked Hulayz to bear with them until they found a solution that was satisfactory to everybody. Their next envoy was Urwa ibn Masud of Ta'if, a crucial ally of Mecca. Urwa immediately put his finger on Muhammad's weak spot. "So, you've gathered this medley of people, O Muhammad, by whom you come back to break the might of your own tribe," said Urwa, gesturing contemptuously at the pilgrims. "By Allah, I could see these disbanding against you tomorrow." Muhammad knew that despite this apparent show of strength and unity, he had very few dependable allies. His Bedouin confederates, who had refused to accompany him on the pilgrimage, had only a superficial commitment to Islam. His position in Medina was still desperately insecure, and he knew that some of his closest companions would not understand what he was about to do. How could he realistically oppose the Quraysh, his own tribe, with this motley rabble? The Quraysh, on the other hand, were solidly united and armed to the teeth, Urwa told him. Even the women and children had vowed to prevent him entering Mecca. Nevertheless, almost in spite of himself, Urwa was impressed by the Muslims' devotion to the Prophet during this crisis, and he told the Quraysh that, at least for the time being, Muhammad held the winning cards, and they would have to make some kind of agreement
with him. Muhammad decided to send an ambassador of his own into Mecca. First, he dispatched one of the helpers, thinking that this would be less inflammatory. But the Quraysh hamstrung the man's camel and would have killed him had not Hulayz's tribesmen intervened. Next, Muhammad approached Omar. But none of his clansmen in the city was strong enough to protect him, so it was decided that the well-connected Uthman ibn Affan should undertake the mission. The Quraysh heard him out, but were not convinced by his exposition of Islam, though they gave him permission to perform the rites of the pilgrimage. Uthman, of course, refused, so the Quraysh decided to keep him as a hostage, but sent word to the Muslims that he had been killed. This was a terrible moment. It seemed as though the expedition had horribly misfired. In this extremity, Muhammad fell into a trance, but this time there was no message from Allah, and he had to find a solution himself, listening, as he always did, to the undercurrent of these fearful events in order to discover what was really going on. Finally, he asked the pilgrims to swear an oath of fealty. One by one, they took his hand and swore the oath of good pleasure. The sources all have different interpretations of this event, but Waqidi's account is probably the most persuasive.
He says that the Muslims vowed to obey Muhammad implicitly and to follow what was in his soul during this crisis. Muhammad had never been able to command absolute obedience. But shaken by the report of Uthman's murder, even Ibn Ubay and the hypocrites were ready to take the oath. Muhammad had resolved, at a deep instinctual level, to take a course of action that he knew many would find intolerable, and he wanted to ensure their loyalty in advance. After everybody had taken the pledge, things began to improve. First came the good news that Uthman had not been killed after all. And then Muhammad saw Suhail, whom he had always respected, approaching the camp, and realized that the Quraysh were now seriously prepared to negotiate. This in itself was an important achievement. At last, Muhammad had compelled the Quraysh to take him seriously, and there was a real possibility of a peaceful solution. Muhammad sat with Suhail for a long time, but the terms that were agreed filled many of his companions with dismay. First, he promised to return to Medina without visiting the Haram, though Suhail promised that the following year the Muslims could return and perform the traditional rites of the Hajj within the city limits. There would be a truce between Mecca and Medina for 10 years. Muhammad promised to return any member of the Quraysh who converted to Islam and made the hijrah to Medina without the consent of his guardians, but agreed that the Quraysh would not have to return a Muslim who defected to Mecca. The Bedouin tribes were released from their former treaty obligations, and they could choose to form an alliance with either Medina or Mecca. The Quran had long stipulated that, in the interests of peace, Muslims must agree to any conditions that the enemy proposed, even if they seemed disadvantageous. But many of the pilgrims found these terms dishonourable. The truce meant that Muslims could no longer raid the Meccan caravans. Why was Muhammad abandoning the economic blockade that was really starting to bite? Why had he consented to return new converts to Mecca when the Quraysh did not have to reciprocate? During the last 5 years, many Muslims had died for their religion. Others had risked everything and given up family and friends. Yet now, Muhammad had calmly handed the advantage back to the Quraysh, and the pilgrims must agree to go home meekly without even forcing the pilgrimage issue. The treaty assaulted every single Jahili instinct. The apostles' companions had gone out without any doubt of occupying Mecca because of the vision the apostle had seen, explained Ibn Ishaq. When they saw the negotiations for peace and a withdrawal going on, and what the apostle had taken on himself, they felt depressed, almost to the point of death.
This ends Disc 5.